Emmy, when did you first become aware that you were different from other people? Do you feel like this is something you've always known?
I think I always thought that I was different, but I didn't really think sociopath, obviously. When I was little, I thought maybe I'm just smart, maybe I'm just Mormon, maybe it's something having to do with my big family, big musical family. Maybe there are other things that are sort of idiosyncratic about me that are just, you know, they're just chance. And I don't think I really realized how systematic my differences were or what their particular nature were until law school, when we were all trained to think like lawyers very logically and rationally. And my classmates and I did that well. And we did it pretty much in lockstep and did it very in similar ways until we started talking about controversial subjects like the death penalty or abortion. And then my classmates would have emotional reactions to these things. And there was an emotional component to their argument. And they had feelings about these particular issues, not just rational think like a lawyer thoughts about them. And I didn't. And I thought, these people are having these very authentic reactions. I'm not having them. I must be very different from them.
Is that the main characteristic you would say makes somebody a sociopath? Lack of feelings?
I think lack of feelings is not necessarily true. I have feelings. And when you think about feelings, we have all sorts of feelings, right? I feel hunger, I feel tired, I feel angry or irritated or upset. And I have all these sorts of feelings. I feel love or at least affection and adoration for certain people. I think the difference between sociopaths and other people is the meaning and context that they give to their feelings. Sociopaths have these feelings. They don't necessarily identify with them or think of them as reflecting any great truth. You know, the same way you wouldn't think that the fact that you're hungry, it makes you a hungry type of person or reflects some, you know, larger social truth. But people who have other feelings about things, they feel maybe repugnance about something, and they think this must be morally wrong. And so I think that there definitely is an emotional component to people's moral judgments. And I think when you look at the research that supports it, and that people have their emotional reactions to something about morality, and then they afterwards try to come up with logical reasons to support those emotional reactions that they've had. You know, why did I have these emotional reactions to the death penalty? It's because the death penalty is wrong or whatever, and come up with rational justifications. So, you know, I think that was the interesting thing in law school to see is people having those emotional reactions and then trying to come up using their lawyer skills to come up with justifications for why they were having those reactions.
Well, people have a lot of stereotypes about what it means to be a sociopath. And one of them is that sociopaths have no feelings or don't empathize with other people. I wanted to ask you, you open the book with this kind of chilling story about, I think you were a teenager maybe, and a baby possum fell into your pool one day. Could you tell that story?
Yeah, so I had planned to do swimming lessons in the pool, and I walked out and was getting everything set, kickboards ready, and then I noticed there was splashing in the pool, and I got close enough to see that it was a baby possum, and I thought, well, we can't have swimming lessons in the pool with a baby possum. Maybe we have to get it out somehow. So in my mind, I thought the best, easiest way and the most risk-free way was to kill it, you know, to help it drown, essentially. And then after it's dead, to get it out, because who knows, you know, you take it out and does it bite you? Does it have rabies? It just didn't seem like the benefits of trying to fish it out outweighed the potential costs.
So you just approached it purely rationally.
Yeah. And, you know, I when I did that, I didn't really think this is like a cruel thing to do, or this is, you know, I'm enjoying killing this animal. It was purely this practical thing to do. And it was only in the retelling of it to other people did I realize that other people would have approached it very differently, you know, and would have had, you know, feelings of guilt almost at killing it. And I think feelings of guilt, I mean, it's a pest, right? It's a pest in the sense that it is an animal that's where it shouldn't be. And we kill animals like that all the time. You know, we have rat traps and, you know, we put down dogs, wild dogs or feral dogs in the street. We just do this, right? But other people their feelings about it are a lot more complicated than mine are, obviously.
So when you told that story to other people, did they kind of gasp and say, oh, my God, why? Why did you do that?
Right, exactly. And I was surprised that they were having these reactions. You know, that's another example of, you know, that happened in my like late teens, early 20s or something, of realizing that you're different. You know, I thought it was almost not a story worth telling. Maybe I just told it on the offhand, like, why didn't you have swimming lessons today? Oh, I canceled them because there was an opossum in the pool that I tried to drown, but it didn't drown quick enough.
And so then when you realized that other people were completely freaking out about this, did that bother you? Or is that another thing that maybe you wouldn't feel?
You know, I didn't really feel bothered by it. I did think, this is interesting that they're having, why are they acting so emotionally about this? You know, it's a baby opossum. Like, it's, I understand that people like baby things. You know, baby anything seems like something that we should try to save, but it just didn't seem like they were being rational at all. Like, their suggestions seemed ridiculous to me. I was going to nurse it back to health or something and try to help it find its mother. I just thought, no, these things aren't going to happen. And, you know, even if I fished it out, what's the chances of it surviving? And it's almost a mercy killing, even if we were to adopt your way of looking at things and trying to be merciful.
Well, you wound up eventually seeking out and getting an actual diagnosis. So you got the label, you're a sociopath. How did that affect you?
I think when I first heard the term sociopath, it was an informal diagnosis. And my friend had said, you know, after, you know, months of talking about ethics, an office coworker, actually, you might want to consider the possibility that you're a sociopath. So I looked it up online and I saw the traits and I thought, yeah, this makes sense. And so in some ways it was relief. I mean, I don't think at the time, this would have been the early 2000s. It was before Dexter had come out and it was before sociopaths became pretty popular, I think, in movies and TV. And so I didn't really have that many, any sort of connotations, pejorative or positive or anything. And when you
really,
traits,
you didn't think, oh my God, they're saying I'm a psycho killer?
Oh, psycho killer. Well, see, sociopath, you know, too, I thought there must be a difference between sociopath and psychos, you know, psychotic. I think I had that understanding. And I think I was pretty aware anyways that I wasn't crazy. So, you know, coming from that stance, you know, I was just some Mormon girl, you know, who had lived this virtuous life, you know, in the eyes of most people, like an overly virtuous life, and really should have been doing more bad things, drinking or sex or whatever. It just didn't seem like I was the type of person that would be, you know, this evil monster. So I didn't see it as being evil monster. I read the traits and charming and charismatic and fearless and, you know, maybe a little bit manipulative, but who isn't? And I just thought, yeah, I mean, I am like this.
So what do you think is responsible for you being a sociopath?
Well, it's very hard to say. And, you know, I'm very careful to say always I'm a diagnosed sociopath. Who even knows, you know, what sociopathy means? I don't think there's nearly enough research to make any sort of for sure statements. But the research that has been done suggests that there's a genetic component. They've done twin studies and found that twins, you know, if one's a sociopath, the other one's much more likely to also be a sociopath. Most people's guess is it's about 50% genetic or 50% sort of inborn, and the rest comes from other sources, environmental, I guess. I would say, you know, if I had to trace the genetic link, it would come from my father's birth father, who abandoned him as a baby, knocked up my grandmother, shotgun wedding, abandoned. And we don't know that much about him because he never met the father, never knew him at all. But we do know that he was very sort of violent, aggressive, had maybe a mood disorder. You know, he had a bunch of scars on his face from all the reckless activities he would engage in. And he ended up losing his money by buying a ranch. He fancied himself a cowboy and then ran the ranch into the ground. Mm. So if I had a guess, I would say he is the source of the genetics.
Mm. But does that mean that sociopaths, that there are actual physical brain differences?
There are physical brain differences. Sociopaths' brains are wired differently, and nobody really knows the cause and effect of that. Is it that the brains are wired differently and that's why sociopaths behave differently? Or is it that sociopaths behave differently so their brain sort of accommodates that different behavior?
Which comes first, chicken and egg? Yeah. So once you got that diagnosis, I mean, by now you write in the book that you identify more as a sociopath than by your gender or profession or race. Can you talk more about that? What does that mean to you?
Yeah, it doesn't actually mean that I identify so strongly with being a sociopath. It largely means I don't identify with the other things. And I think one of the primary characteristics of sociopaths, what it feels like to be a sociopath, is to have a very weak sense of self. You know, there's sort of no there there. I don't think of myself in these terms, you know, female or part of a particular political party, or, you know, even my age, my ethnicity, even Mormonism to a certain extent. I've never really felt Mormon. So people see me and see all these different characteristics and treat me that way, but I never really think of myself in those terms. I think of myself more in terms of how I process things, you know, how I think rather than the results. So more like the formula rather than the particular inputs or the outputs of the formula.
But that's interesting that you say you don't have a sense of self. That's just such an interesting concept. For one thing, you must understand something about a sense of self to know that you don't have one.
Right.
How did you figure out what you were missing?
That's a good question. You know, not having a sense of self, I guess, what does it feel like? It sort of feels like I am a mirror or a camera. You know, I am just capturing other things. I think the figuring out that I didn't have a sense of self was experiencing things like, you know, the law school experience, where people had very strong opinions. And I always felt like the opinions I had were largely convenient. You know, I had them for that particular context or for that particular moment, or maybe even just to portray a particular role in society, whatever I was doing. And I always thought I can change my mind the very next minute. And so I think, you know, probably actually in my relationships, my personal relationships, is where it felt most obvious, because I felt that way. You know, I say this all the time, that, you know, if tomorrow I could be out of a relationship, if I happen to be in a relationship, that I make a decision to be whoever I am or whatever role that I have every day, you know, make a decision to keep my job every day. I feel like I could quit every day. Same thing with relationships, same thing with everything that I participate in. I think I can move tomorrow. Mm-hmm. You know, everything is kind of constantly I'm deciding these things. It's not something that's rigid or solid. I think that really scares people when they're in a relationship with me, because it doesn't seem secure.
Well, you also write that one of your favorite pastimes is what you call the fine art of ruining people, which you describe as inserting yourself in someone else's psyche and quietly wreaking as much havoc as you can. For example.
Well, yeah, favorite pastimes. I mean, I think that might be overstating it a little bit. I say in the book, it's sort of a delicacy that I engage in as often as I eat foie gras, which is, you know, I mean, I haven't eaten foie gras in for forever. And ruining people, too. It's something that I did more before I was undiagnosed and, you know, wasn't really aware of the consequences of some of my actions. But the appeal to ruining people was sort of an intimacy with people. You know, I really like people. I actually do really like people, but it has been hard. You know, as I said, with relationships and other things, it's been hard to have any sort of sense of intimacy with people, emotional, physical, anything. And I think ruining people in some ways was just a way to interact with people. You know, it's like the difference between hugging somebody and roughhousing with them, you know, punching them. They can mean the same thing, actually. They can both mean affection, or you want to engage with that particular thing. And so ruining people was almost like an emotional roughhousing.
So what? What's an example? How have you ruined someone?
Ruining people, I mean, the examples are actually pretty, it's not like they actually are ruined. That's the biggest point, I guess, to make first, is they don't end up, you know, a shell of their former selves. It's just a mind game, basically. You try to get in their mind. You try to get them to like you, you know, get them to sort of rely on you for particular things. You get them to wonder what your motives are. You're just playing mind games with them. It's like seducing them, probably in a way, except you're not actually, the goal is not to, you know, be in a relationship with them or get them to do particular things. You just want to inhabit their mind. You want them to think of you and wonder what you think about.
Well, you tell the story about this this young, successful lawyer, Morgan, for instance, who by the time you finish your relationship with her, you said she had been young and successful, and by the end she was an anorexic who'd lost her job and involved in substance abuse. That sounds like ruining.
Yeah, you know, Morgan, you know, we're actually still friends, Morgan and I. I wouldn't take credit for those things. I do think that she, and this is something that I've kind of adapted over the years to seek after people who have sort of masochistic tendencies. You know, they're, for whatever reason, they're wanting to self-destruct or their life is unstable. And so I become a part of that. I don't necessarily lead them to do those things. You know, that those were her choices, but her vulnerability, you know, and her instability, I think, attracted me because it was so easy to kind of get into her head. But I don't think she would think of me as a negative influence in her life, actually. You know, if anything, I've sort of been a stabilizing influence or at least an interesting influence. You know, she wants to engage in these sorts of things. And most people would really judge her for that sort of behavior and think, you know, you're ruining your life and how could you? And we're not going to support you anymore. And we're, you know, I'm going to stop being your friend because I just can't see you do this to yourself. And I was always supportive of whatever she chose to do. So
I still really want to understand that thing you said about ruining people is a, what did you say, delicious, a delicacy? And I'm
right.
I found this section in your book where you say the same thing, and then you say sociopaths are uniformly hungry for power, and power is all you've ever really cared about in your life. So help me understand, like, what is it that's delicious about ruining people, and how's that related to power?
So probably the source of both of those, I think, and this is something that I don't understand myself 100%. And sociopaths, you can see that sociopaths are very power motivated, but I don't know if I know for sure why that is. My guess is, you know, kind of my working theory now, it's maybe a little bit crazy, is that if you believe that sociopathy is on the autism spectrum, which some people do, and I sort of suspect they're at least related, you know, they both have problems with empathy, they both have problems with their own internal emotional worlds, they both have problems conforming to social norms, right? And some people who on the autism spectrum or Asperger's, they're sort of savants about particular topics. They have pet topics that they really enjoy. And mm-hmm. So, you know, railroads or whatever it happens to be, they're very interested in the planets and they become experts on it. And I think in some ways, sociopaths act like people with Asperger's or on the autism spectrum, that their interest happens to be other people, and they've studied other people, and they're very interested in other people, and they're fascinated with other people, but they still have these problems connecting with them emotionally. And so what do you do in those situations? You're so kind of obsessed with these people, right? And you want to be able to engage with them. And so how, you know, if you don't have the normal sorts of ways of interacting with people, how do you engage with them? You can see your influence on them. You can see that you have a relationship with them by the way they react to you. And so in a lot of ways, power just is a reflection of your influence on the other person. And it shows that you have a relationship with this person. And it shows that you two occupy the same sort of small world. I think that's really important.
What about the occasional desire to do harm? I mean, which is the thing that, of course, that makes people so scared of sociopaths. I mean, there's this this incident, for instance, you describe when you were in a metro in a new city and you had an interaction with a metro worker. I should just get you to tell the story.
Yeah. So I was in Washington, D.C., and, you know, I was going down this escalator and he said, didn't you see the yellow gate? And I said, what yellow gate? And he said, you know, you're trespassing. This escalator is closed. And he went on and lectured me about trespassing and how I shouldn't do that. And it was a very bad thing to do. And I just kind of stared at him and was getting kind of angry because what yellow gate and why is he making such a big deal about this? You know, and then he said, so you're not going to do this anymore. We're OK now. Right. But I didn't think it was OK. You know, why had he felt like he was able to sort of make these moral judgments and try to morally shame me in these particular ways? So something in me kind of snapped, you know, and I would say it is probably a fight or a flight response. In this case, fight for sure, you know, and it kind of seems weird, I think, to some people that you might react this way. But I think people react this way a lot, you know, road rage. You feel like somebody has violated your sort of personal space or, you know, has themselves violated a social norm and kind of deserves what they get. So I start trailing him and thinking, you know, how I'm going to strangle him, you know, if I ever get my hands on him. But he loses himself in the crowd and I quickly calm down, as most people do when you experience these sort of primitive fight or flight reactions. But I think, you know, like, so I wouldn't even say that was a desire to harm that I had consciously thought, you know, I wouldn't say that that is something that I experience all the time. I think everybody has particular triggers, but this other desire to harm, I don't think it's so abnormal, a general desire to harm. A lot of people enjoy creative pursuits, and I think people also enjoy, you know, sometimes destructive pursuits. If you could, would you, you know, we have to tear down this house, and here is a wrecking ball. Do you want to be in charge of the wrecking ball? I think most people would think, yeah, that sounds like fun. There's a little bit of joy in destruction. You know, we have to tear down this wall. Here's a sledgehammer. You know,
but are you thinking partly that the difference between you and somebody else, because anybody could have felt enraged by this officious metro worker, but do you think the reason you trailed after him having fantasies of that you might or might not have acted on, having fantasies of wrapping your hands around his neck, do you think that's because you have a different sense of morality? You know, somebody else's, a more normative person, might have thought, oh, what a terrible thought, and shoved it out of their mind and not followed. But maybe you didn't have that kind of sense of moral breaks.
I definitely think I have different triggers than other people. You know, certain things don't bother me at all. I could care less that people do certain things. You know, certain people, you know, why is there racial tension? You know, why do people still fight the, you know, say that there's a homosexual agenda? You know, people have different things that kind of work them up and enrage them for whatever reason. And this guy just happened to have tripped on one of my triggers, which is public shaming. I think it's largely from my childhood. It was kind of a classic method of my father growing up to try to shame people. And for me, when people are trying to morally shame me, it's sort of insulting because I don't understand why he thinks that that was morally wrong, walking on his escalator when there was a yellow gate. And so for him to kind of be shouting at me in this way and saying, you've done this moral wrong thing, it's almost like if I were deaf and he were, you know, shouting at me, or, you know, I spoke a different language and he was shouting at me in English. It's like, you know, I don't understand what you're talking about. And for you to be so sure of yourself is kind of offensive to me. It's you're not really acknowledging my point of view at all.
Well, you've written that your view of morality is instrumental. And what do you mean? Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
I think I don't really have this emotional view of morality. It's largely ethically based. It's largely utilitarian. To the extent, you know, I have raised in the Mormon church and taught to serve others, and that, you know, raised in a large family, I was able to see early on that when my siblings are happy, when my parents are happy, when people, my friends are happy, I'm happier. And so I really kind of took to this idea of utilitarian ethics.
Hmm. Do you see any connection between your work as a lawyer and a law professor and being a sociopath? I mean, I'm wondering if that instrumental view of morality is actually very helpful when you're practicing law.
Definitely. I think it's very helpful. I think particularly when you are a lawyer, you know, a judge or a jury, everybody has different roles. But when you're a lawyer, your job is to advocate very strongly on behalf of your client. And you're supposed to set aside your own personal feelings and your own sense of morality. You're not supposed to think, this guy's a bad guy, he deserves to go to jail, and so I'm just going to phone it in. I'm not going to do a good job representing him. That's not really your role in the process. It's an adversarial process, and it only works when both attorneys are representing their sides as strongly as they can. So I think sociopaths, you know, they don't really have the same sort of temptation to be judge, jury, and executioner, which is why I think they make, in a lot of cases, better attorneys than the people who are very kind of have very strong moral reactions to things.
But on the other hand, wouldn't a sociopath be more tempted to bend the law?
That is, you know, it kind of depends on your view of how well the system functions. I think that it's actually pretty difficult to bend the law and not get caught. I think most people who bend the law and try not to get caught, Bernie Madoff types, they tend to be more narcissistic and think that they're never going to get caught. Especially a sociopath who's a lawyer, you know, what advantage does he have of bending the law? If he gets caught, you know, he doesn't really recoup all the gains to his client of bending the law, but he could be disbarred, he could be imprisoned. And I don't really think that there's a strong temptation. I think the law actually functions pretty well that way.
You know, listening to you, one of the things that interests me is that, you know, most of us believe we've never met a sociopath, but research shows that, in fact, they make up, I don't know what, like 25% of the population, which means that, and many of them have very successful careers. Can you recognize other sociopaths?
Right. So it's, 1 in 25. So 1 to 4% of the population. Sometimes I recognize sociopaths, and it is kind of scary to think, you know, statistically everybody has met a sociopath, but most people cannot ever recall having met a sociopath. If they met a sociopath, they didn't know it. And I think that has happened to me too. I think I've met sociopaths and not realized it. I've also met sociopaths and did realize it. And, you know, I think there is kind of ways that you can tell. They tend to hold eye contact, you know, and then it kind of becomes a staring contest. If it's sociopath against sociopath, then it's just like really intense staring at each other for however many minutes. There are other ways to try to flush people out. You know, sometimes I like to bring up the TV show Dexter and ask them how they feel about things, about Dexter. And if I think a lot of times sociopaths are sort of dropping hints, you know, about themselves. They want to be discovered. They want to, you know, they rarely flat out lie. They largely kind of tell the truth in ways that are not really going to out themselves, but they can still kind of be their own sort of authentic, express their own authentic thoughts about something.
So is that why you wrote the book? Because that, I mean, that's a risky thing to do. You are, after all, as you've said, a lawyer and a practicing law professor, and you wrote it under a pseudonym, but still you wrote a very frank book about what it's like to be you.
Right. It's an incredibly risky thing to do. It might have been a huge mistake. But I do think that, you know, when I started writing the blog, I guess, is when I started realizing how much of a double life I live. The blog, when I would write the blog, Sociopath World, I would be very frank and very honest and open. And I would have these authentic interactions with people, both sociopaths and non-sociopaths. And then I would go to work and present this other face to people. And I started actually preferring the blog life. I started preferring to be so honest and authentic and open. And for me, you know, I just don't really care about some of these trappings of success, the money or the prestige. I would rather just be happy. You know, I guess that's just, you know, because I'm a sociopath maybe, and I just seek my own pleasure. And so those things happen to make me happier. And so I thought I would rather be more open and honest with people. And I also think that it's, you know, having experienced my own troubles with things, trying to figure out who I am. I mean, I spent years trying to figure out what exactly I am, who I am, why I do the things that I do, and I still struggle with the traits of being a sociopath, the impulsivity, the tendency to self-destruct every few years. I just think there has to be a better way, and any way to shed light on the disorder, I think, and try to get people thinking more about it, possibly getting more research funded, because it's really under-researched. It's shockingly under-researched, considering how prevalent it is. And I've heard some people cite that sociopaths cause economies trillions of dollars. I don't know if that's true or not, but it seems like a serious issue that we have these people, we don't really know what to do with them. I also think in terms of wanting what's best for society, you know, just normal people, in this world of globalization that the countries and the societies who figure out how to integrate their sociopaths and take advantage of some of the good traits of a sociopath are going to have a competitive advantage over the ones who can't. And the sociopaths just end up, you know, becoming criminals or doing whatever else they choose to do.
So I'm curious, what would you say today to someone who is maybe the parent of a young child who's a sociopath?
Oh, I think that's one of the trickiest situations you could possibly be in, is to be the parent of a young sociopath, because you really, there's such a strong stigma, it would be extremely irresponsible of you to make it at all public that this child is possibly a sociopath, because then they're stuck with that label for the rest of their lives, and it's really going to affect what they're able to do in their life. So there's almost no help for you, you know, apart from being completely anonymous or trying to, you know, deal with therapists who are never going to be freaked out and say that this child represents a threat and violate the patient doctor confidentiality provisions, right? So there's not a lot of help out there for them. And I really feel badly for them. And I try to, in the book, address this a little bit and have tried to sort of brainstorm other ways to help them. You know, that there are definitely tricks. There are things that you can do, and there are things that are horrible to do. I think the shaming is the worst thing that you could do. The, you know, speaking in the language of morality is just going to enrage the child sociopath. They're going to think, these people don't understand me. They don't see the world the way I see it, and I don't see the way that they see it, and so it doesn't make sense to me.
What does work?
Oh, incentives. I think incentives work. Being very, very consistent. Sociopaths love games, as we've been talking about, but they hate rigged games. If the game is rigged, if they feel like, you know, they do one thing one day and they get this result, they do the same thing the other day and they get a completely opposite result, they're not going to want to play, or they're going to just think, if the game's rigged, then I'm going to figure out how it's rigged. I'm going to keep, you know, rigging it myself so it's rigged in to my benefit. And those are the opposite things that you want to teach a child sociopath, is to think that all social institutions or rules are just there to be played with.
And what would you say to a young, maybe teenage sociopath who's just coming of age, knows they're different, but doesn't know why or how exactly?
Right, that doesn't know why or how. I mean, I think that there are now some resources for them to turn to. I think that, you know, the book, my book, obviously, blog, I tried to have, there's a forum where people kind of connect and try to connect with other people. I think that's good to have a support group in that way. I think that the researchers have been getting better. I think that traditionally, a lot of research done in this area has been from people who don't like sociopaths, who actually think that they're kind of evil. And it would be sort of like if all the abortion research, for instance, was done by the pro-life people. You know, there's been a definite slant on the research. And I think that there's been some interesting research that's happened lately that has been really helpful. There actually was some recent research out of the Netherlands. They probably are least kind of morally invested in issues for various reasons, that suggest that sociopaths do feel empathy as long as you direct their attention. You know, if you say, imagine that you are this person, and then you watch some guy get his hand hit by a hammer, then that they do have the mirror neurons lighting up in their brain. And so I think there's a lot of hope out there. I think that there's still a long way to go. I think that I would recommend that they not get diagnosed because of the stigma. And there really aren't the strong enough legal protections out there if they have that diagnosis, you know, and they aren't admitted into a school, you know, a university, or they don't get a particular job. They don't really have legal recourse, I think, or strong enough legal recourse to make it worth getting the diagnosis, which is unfortunate because we're basically saying, you know, don't get diagnosed, don't get treated, otherwise you're going to leave a paper trail.
Emmy, thank you so much for talking and for being brave enough to share your own story.
Thank you.
Okay. We're done. Anything you wanted to say that I didn't give you a chance to say?
No, I think that was really great.
Okay. Yeah, you were terrific. Yeah. Thank you very much. That was a great interview. Thank you.
Thank you.